All set to go?
Yeah, the Environment, Economic Development, and Agriculture Division for Wednesday, March 12, 2014 will come to order. We're going to go off the order of the agenda a bit here and start out with Senator Pappas, Senate File 2323. Senator Pappas, go ahead. We're not going to take any votes on any of these today unless you have some kind of amendments you need to add to your bills, but we'll lay them over for possible inclusion in another bill. So, Senator Pappas, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. Twin Cities Rise has been before this committee many times before and has received very generous support from the state. Twin Cities Rise provides high-quality, effective work skills training and coaching to adults from generational poverty, focused on placing and living wage jobs and long-term job retention. Over 20 years, they've placed and retained more than 1,000 adults in good jobs that paid over $20,000 per year. I have with me this morning Mr. Tom Streitz, who's the executive director of Twin Cities Rise, and he'll make a few comments, and then he'll introduce the other witnesses.
Okay. Well, go ahead, and just say your name for the record before you speak, and then just go ahead with your presentation. Okay.
Tom Streitz. I'm president and CEO of Twin Cities Rise. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. Senator Pappas, thank you for that introduction. I'm pleased to be here. Twin Cities Rise is an innovative job training program dedicated to breaking entrenched cycles of poverty in our community. Income inequality and erasing racial disparities in education and employment have been identified by the President, Governor Mark Dayton, and the mayors of Minneapolis and St. Paul as one of the most critical issues of our time. 20 years ago, Twin Cities Rise was formed by a General Mills executive with a simple but profound goal in mind, to help break the cycle of poverty in low-income communities, in particular in communities of color, and for men who face generational and entrenched barriers to meaningful long-term employment by training them and placing them in living wage jobs with long-term retention. As Senator Pappas alluded to, over 20 years ago, TCR has helped over 1,000 low-income participants break out of poverty and attain living wage jobs with benefits and long-term retention. We've formed relationships with hundreds of employers throughout the state, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the region. TCR pioneered and has been a leader in pay-for-performance model in the state of Minnesota. We've enjoyed over a 16-year partnership with the state that's paid the state back numerous ways. In addition to, for every dollar invested by the state, we've returned $7 to the state for a total of $39 million over a period of 16 years. It's a record that stands on its own and I think has been highly beneficial. We know that poverty is a bipartisan issue. It's a colorblind issue. However, we also know that certain communities in our state are affected disproportionately by poverty. We also know that the fastest way out of poverty is a living wage job that is sustained over the long term. This is the simple premise of Twin Cities Rise that has strong bipartisan support over many years. Last year, Twin Cities Rise raised over $2.5 million in private and corporate support for our work and received no state funding. This year, we're asking the state to be a small but important partner in our work, so as we go out and raise funds to do this important job, we can say the state is our partner, as the state has been over a period of many years. Thank you for this opportunity to engage you in this timely and critical effort in our community. And with that, I want to turn it over to one of our long-term board members, Don Samuels.
Before you go there, so you got no money from the state last year because of the competitive grant program, or
Mr. Chair and Senators, yes, that's correct.
Okay, and prior to that, how much did you get from the state?
Over a period of years, we had to pay for performance with the contract with the state. That the state paid us $9,000 for every participant placed in a long-term job.
Okay. And
with the cash.
And how did you collect that money? Just based on the number of people that went to work?
Based on the number of people that went through the program.
Okay.
That's right.
All right. And so that was denied in the competitive grant program, or were you asking for a lump sum like in this particular bill?
Mr. Chair, Senators, during the competitive grant process, by the way, I am the new president and CEO, of Twin Cities Rise. Twin Cities Rise was not funded under the competitive process. Now, my understanding is, and I don't want to spend a lot of time going backwards, is number one, they didn't have a lot of money over at DEED. And number two, it was a new process. So one of the things we're committed to, and I've had a great conversation with Commissioner Steven and also with Cynthia Bowerly is moving forward, we want to work with the state and with DEED for a new process and program that we think maybe will benefit everybody. And a larger pie, frankly, is what's needed to serve what we want to accomplish in the state and at Twin Cities Rise.
Okay. Let's go to your other witnesses. Just say your name for the record, please.
Don Samuels. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. The state and I have a lot in common regarding Twin Cities Rise in that for years I have been a fan of Twin Cities Rise, and to the degree that I eventually became a board member about 3 years ago. I live in the community, the most challenged community. The folks that this money goes to are my neighbors. And so I have a keen sense of what the needs are and a keen eye for what works and what doesn't work. And I'll give you an example of some of the challenges that the DEED encounters in trying to get money to be effective on the ground. DEED supported the relocation of Coloplast's national headquarters from Atlanta to Minneapolis. In North Minneapolis, 515 new jobs coming in. And, of course, there was a window or a margin that was going to be able to absorb Northsiders over time. And through job training programs and the deal that DEED made with Coloplast in order to get some funding, a few dozen employees were hired. And after 2 years, not one of those employees was retained by Coloplast. There were problems with attendance and showing up on time, basically. And so you begin to see then when you are on the ground at that level, the importance of these aspects of training that are missing way too often. And
So were any of those employees in the RISE program?
No, none of them were.
Okay, all right.
And so you begin to see the importance of these subtle psychological aspects of training to get rid of some of the perceptions, misconceptions that are in people's minds or coming from very challenged histories. And that's why I love Twin Cities Rise's empowerment program. If you look in your packet, you'll see it might sound kind of touchy-feely, but believe me, this is hardcore internal work where members look at themselves and are challenged to revisit the issues that might sabotage their careers. And that is why by the time they graduate from Twin Cities Rise, their retention rates for the companies in which they are placed is greater than the average employee in those companies. The average, not the hard to place, but greater than the average employees. And that's why we get such support, and many of our board members come from those companies. I'm really thrilled. The second thing I would like to say is that at some point a few years ago, we noticed that our outcomes were increasing. When we looked at it, we were increasing because we were increasingly attracting easier to hire people. And so the board had a tough conversation. Are we going to go after that hardcore component that we initially formed this organization to reach, or are we going to just have great outcomes and get more money? And we dug deep and decided that we're going to stick with that hard-to-hire cohort, and we're going to work hard and develop the mechanisms necessary to take them to where they need to be long-term employees and productive over the long range. So I urge you to look at the outcomes that we are able to produce and understand that something unique is happening at Twin Cities Rise, and that's why we are able to challenge ourselves to live up to a pay-for-performance way of financing.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Senators, if I may, also I want to introduce...
For the record, a quorum is present. Okay, go ahead.
I want to introduce Mr. Tony Blakey, who is a former participant at Twin Cities Rise and now an employee at Twin Cities Rise.
Okay, welcome, Mr. Blakey. Just say your name for the record, please.
Sure. Tony Blakey, and good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. So I want to start by saying thank you for allowing me to express myself for a couple of moments this morning. As a graduate of Twin Cities Rise and currently a work skills coach and instructor at Twin Cities Rise, my experience has been rather unique. I came to Twin Cities Rise back in 2007 without much guidance and outlook on my future. What Twin Cities Rise provided me with at that point in time was some essential skills to really begin to make decisions that were based on or out of my positive self-interest, and where I thought I did not have any value in going through our very powerful and valuable empowerment program, I began to understand that my life was of significant consequence and that I really had something to offer to employers. As time went on and I really grew in confidence, I happened to be in the right place at the right time through our internship program and was offered an opportunity to become part of the staff at Twin Cities Rise. Now in my role as part of the staff, again, I am a work skills coach, and I really work with individuals to help them overcome the barriers that they have to employment. Some of them have criminal backgrounds. Others may have never worked before. Others may be looking just to make a transition in their chosen career paths. However, Twin Cities Rise really works with individuals on various levels with various backgrounds. And we do our really best to work with individuals in meeting them exactly where they are. Oftentimes, individuals come in and they have the necessary skills to work with Twin Cities Rise to gain employment in 2 to 3 sessions. Others, it may be 6 to 12 months. However, it is a program that really works with individuals, again, to meet them where they are, to address their foundational issues, and like myself as a graduate, at some point in time, become a productive taxpaying member of society. Since being employed at Twin Cities Rise, I've caught up on taxes that I was behind on, so I am no longer in debt, if you will, or in trouble with the IRS, thank God. I have a very good relationship with my two boys, which was sort of shaky and rocky at the beginning for me before I came to Twin Cities Rise. And again, I have the awesome opportunity of working with individuals who have similar experiences to mine, who are now looking again to be productive taxpaying members of society. And one other thing that I want to mention is that Twin Cities Rise may not be a magic pill. It doesn't work overnight. Twin Cities Rise may not also be a conduit for changing the world. However, Twin Cities Rise can serve and is serving as a conduit for individuals to spark individuals in individuals' hope and the potential for making change in the world. And your support of the Twin Cities Rise program to continue to be successful, not just as an organization, but successful in the assistance provided to our participants, would be greatly appreciated. And once again, I appreciate you taking the time to hear me out this morning. Thanks so much.
Well, I really appreciate it, because I think of all the people at the table, you're the only one that doesn't have any notes, and you did that really well.
That's right.
He's talking personal experience.
Yes, yes, from the heart, yes, exactly. So how did you get into Twin Cities Rise? I mean, did you walk in the door? Did somebody find you looking for a job? How did you end up there?
Sure. I have a background. I have a felony background. And at one point in time, I had contacted another program, and they told me that I was not eligible for their program because I hadn't spent enough time incarcerated. And at that point in time, I was also ready.
You didn't go back to prison, did you?
No. So at that point in time, although ready to just sort of throw my hands up in the air, saying nothing is ever going to work, I'm not going to get a second opportunity, I went to hang the phone up, but just happened to hear this person say, well, hold on a minute. There is a program that might be able to help you. And it was Twin Cities Rise. So for me, Twin Cities Rise is sort of like a godsend. It was sort of meant to happen, and I'm certainly glad that it did.
So in your case, you were just kind of lucky to find out about it.
In my case, you could say that. Mm-hmm. But there are various ways that participants come to Twin Cities Rise. It's through word of mouth. It's through past participants who have had such a great experience with Twin Cities Rise. It's also through our recruitment efforts as well.
Okay. All right. Senator Pappas, council has a maybe a correction to the bill that we might need to fix. But the question is, you want if you get this funding, you want it to be based on the $9,000 that per participant as it was before, correct? So you want it to be governed by the same statute. It's, you just don't want a $600,000 appropriation. Is that what I'm hearing, or is that?
Senator Thompson, senators, you know, we can certainly do that. That's what we've done in the past, and we're comfortable with that model.
Okay, so, but I'm just wondering if that's what you want to do here, or if you...
I didn't put in the pay-for-performance model in this particular request.
Okay. All right. And we won't... We'll leave it out for right now. Okay. All right.
Mr. Chairman, maybe we could have discussions about that offline, because, you know, there have been a number of graduates that did not receive the pay-for-performance payment because they didn't get the grant. They weren't chosen during the competitive grant. And maybe we could have some discussions about past pay for performance.
Well, okay. But this would not be, would have, the way it's written right now, I don't think it would have anything to do with the competitive grant program. It would just be a straight up
appropriation. That's correct.
Right.
That's
okay.
Correct.
All right. Okay. All right.
I just wanted to wrap up with one comment, is that on average, participants coming into the program are making on average $2,700 a year, and after they graduate, on average, they're making $27,000. So there's a tenfold increase in their income, and at that point, they're able to support their families, they're able to pay taxes, and really be part of society.
Okay. All right. I appreciate it. Any comments from the committee? Does anybody need to testify on this? Okay. Well, thank you all for coming. Senator Pappas, we're going to lay it over for we haven't figured out exactly if we're going to have an omnibus bill here or not, but it could possibly be part of an omnibus bill. So we're going to lay it over and have it on the table ready for something else. So, okay?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
all
you.
Right. Okay. Commissioner. So as long as you're up there, so why didn't they get any money this time around?
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Katie Clark Sieben, the Commissioner of Deed. It was a, and I know competitive grants is on our list to talk about today, but it was a very competitive process. We received numerous requests beyond the appropriation that we had to distribute, and they're an excellent organization.
How much did we have to distribute? I thought we gave you all kinds of money last year.
Mr. Chair, we had $6,237,700 to distribute. We received $20,326,004 in requests from organizations.
Okay. All right, go ahead with your presentation. I think you're here on the governor's supplemental budget recommendations.
Correct. So, Mr. Chair, members, thank you for inviting me here today. I thought we could start with the Angel Tax Credit funding in the governor's budget. The governor has recommended $15 million per year in funding for the Angel Tax Credit program.
For members, this is on page 18 of the budget readout that you've got there, and it's the commissioner is starting at the top of the page where it says investing in innovation. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The legislature passed and deed launched the Angel Tax Credit Program in July of 2010 to encourage private investment in technology startups in the state, particularly software, medical device, and biotechnology firms. Under the program, qualified investors can receive a tax credit of 25% on investments of at least $10,000 in high-tech startups in Minnesota. To become a qualified business, startups must be headquartered in Minnesota, have half of their employees in Minnesota, and pay high wages. And investors must hold their investment for 3 years. Both businesses and investors are monitored through required annual reporting. Given there are various definitions of startups, I'd just like to provide a definition as to what type of business is typically supported through this program. This program is about spurring innovation and supporting entrepreneurs during a very challenging time in the business life cycle. The average startup supported through this program is very early stage, most commonly working on raising Series A capital, anywhere from $300,000 to $3 million, usually has one or two employees, is still working on developing their product and bringing it to market. At this early stage in the business life cycle, entrepreneurs typically turn to investors who will support their business without having to develop expensive pitches or travel to meet investors on their small budgets. Those individuals are often family and friends of the entrepreneur, and the Angel Tax Credit is allowing a high-tech startup business to survive during a time when many of these businesses would not. Many of these businesses would not make it to a venture capital round without this source of support. The Angel Tax Credit allows the entrepreneur to further develop their technology, often software, medical devices, or biotechnology products, and prepare to present to larger investors or venture capital firms. As required by statute, the Department of Revenue recently completed a study of this program and its return on investment. The study was conducted by Economic Development Research Group. The program has attracted $212 million in private investment since it started, according to this study. It also supported an average of 512 jobs at Minnesota startup firms from 2010 to 2012, and that number is expected to climb to an average of 635 jobs from 2013 to 2020. And remember, we're talking about early stage companies, so we're not expecting huge job numbers at this point in the life cycle, but the idea is to invest in these early stage businesses so that we can identify the next 3M or Medtronic that down the road will have significant job creation numbers.
Are these companies all across the board, or are they just mostly in the high-tech industry, or what?
They are in the high-tech industry.
Are they in an incubator building, or are they in a garage, or where are they?
There are all forms. Some are based out of garages and homes. Some are in an incubator setting. But many have one or two employees, are still working on developing their market, and are raising capital, focused on raising capital.
And so our $15 million in credits has leveraged $212 million so far? Is that what you said?
Yes. Since the program started, it's leveraged $212 million in private investment, so since 2010.
Okay.
Of that, we're aware that $71.7 million would not have happened without this tax credit, the study determined through investor surveys. The study also found that 40% of surveyed investors would not have made their investment without the Angel Tax Credit, 34% would not have made as large of an investment as they did, 68% of investors report the program increased their awareness of investment opportunities in Minnesota, and 29% of investors report the program increased their awareness of investment opportunities in Greater Minnesota specifically. We're also aware that many of the Angel Tax Credit investments were made in the Twin Cities metropolitan region, and we know that many of the startups have already expanded their businesses to Greater Minnesota as they work to manufacture their products. We see that entrepreneurs tend to locate near entrepreneurs to be surrounded by individuals who know how to raise capital and how to bring a product to market. But as their business grows, they need additional square footage, manufacturing facilities, and we expect that this will impact other areas of our state as this program continues. It's still in the very early stages of this program. And Mr. Chair, we do have one testifier this morning. I'd like to invite Promote, founder of Nirva Medical. His company has participated in the Angel Tax Credit program since 2012.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Just state your name for the record.
Thank you, sir. My name is Promote Hojilan. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for inviting me to share my passion with you. She makes some introduction, and I heard your comments about the whether or not the incubator or the garage startup. We are the garage startup, and I actually do all my R&D in my basement, actually competing with the laundry room.
Are you on that Cadillac commercial?
I'm the founder and everything else at Novamed, which is We are developing the new technologies to actually not just make the heart attack treatment better, but actually a changing heart attack treatment. I'm sure that, unfortunately, I think that all of us here would have someone or have some loved one who actually affected or have heart attack. My three uncles have heart attack and one actually died because of it. We are sitting next to...
Are you watching what you eat?
I am, and okay, I'm trying to stay healthy for both personal and business reasons, because if I don't, I'm not healthy, I cannot work.
Okay.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for your very genuine concern. I really mean that. I didn't mean to.
I was genuine.
I'm sorry. we have Medtronics and we have Boston Scientific.
Next election, I'm going to have Senator Tomasoni concerned chair.
We have these guys next to us, and I would say I don't know the precise number. I would say that probably not far enough, not too far off half of the stent make in the world that actually make from here. And stent, as most people probably would know, is the first choice for treatment of heart attack. But what people hear, and even in medical community, I myself is trained as medical doctor as well, but doing more research. But even in medical communities, what people don't realize is that when the doctor use stent to open the blocked artery to get the flow back to the tissue, which is intuitive, but the flow that going back to the tissue actually attacking the tissue. And this phenomenon is very well known. It's called reperfusion injury. It's known before I was born, unfortunately. But nothing else we can do about that, because when you have the blocked artery, the first thing you have to do is open the blocked artery, otherwise the patient would die because of starving. But now we actually let the cell die because of inflammation of the flow that coming back. Also long ago, 20, 30 years ago, scientists already know that by simple cooling the heart can prevent these inflammations. And many, many animal studies actually shows that we can reduce 80% of tissue death, or in other words, the heart muscle death. And these associated with complications, both short and long term, like, arrhythmia, the abnormal rhythm of the heart, that's why we need pacemaker or a defibrillator, and heart failures that obviously impact, have a lot of economic impact and poor quality of life. So the current cooling technology in the market is too slow. It's not enough. So in clinical trial, it doesn't show anything at all. So what Novamed is doing is we actually develop the localized heart cooling, which is very fast. And we did the animal study last year in December. Like I said, this is real technology from my laundry room and go to animal study. It's actually most of this equipment would be almost ready for human. We actually shows that we actually found that we can cool down the area. Remember I said that cooling is benefit is known. The problem is that it's too slow. Now, in December, we were amazed by that too, because it was our first such study. We showed that our technology can cool down the heart within 2 minutes. To give you the perspective of what it means is that the current cooling technology and the fastest in the market take an hour to cool the heart. On average, it takes about 2 to 3 hours. So we are more than 30 times faster than the current cooling technology in the market. This is phenomenon. We got a lot of support from our clinical advisors, from Harvard, from Columbia, from Henry Ford in Detroit area. These are big, big names, well-respected interventional cardiologists in the world. I have to say that none of this would not happen at all without the AngioTax credit. I have the compelling story right now to tell you. Actually, if I can give you PowerPoint, I will show you the infrared picture that showing the fast development of the cooling on the heart. But when we raised money in 2012, we did not have any of the story. I mean, we have the story, but we don't have any of the evidence. it was the dream, and it was the idea, and it was the belief of a guy like me. I was I was a scientist at Boston Scientific. So I was a pure scientist. I remember, I don't even know anything about business. When I start business network, my first question to people was that, what actually, no offense, but what actually marketing is? I have no idea whatsoever. So I don't have any business background. I don't have any business network. I myself, first generation immigrant from Thailand. I came here for graduate school. So I don't have friends and family that can help me fund, you know, the early stage, which means that the highest risk. So all in all, my point here is that this is the high risk of the high risk. And you now know FDA have a lot of changes or something like that. So I was lucky enough to find someone who believe in this technology. But it will be difficult for them, too, to risk their money when we don't have anything at all to prove. So because of the angel tax credit, you know, 25% is 25, but when you look at that, 1/4 of their investment, they get returned right away. When I pitch to them, it's like, okay, you get your investment return right away. It's part of it, you know, and actually almost immediately, just wait for a year before, you know. And that's what get them, you know, to be willing to actually take a risk with me. And I also want to report, too, that more than 80%, almost 90% of my funding that I raised in 2012 actually come from Pennsylvania. It doesn't come from here. But so far, all my development works is actually spending money here in Minnesota. So we actually attract a lot of money here, but we will be spending money here. We're still early, like the commissioner said, but this heart attack, everybody knows that is a huge problem in the world, not just in the United States. And unfortunately, China is going to eat better, well, maybe worse. They're going to have more heart attack, and Indian going to have more heart attack. So we estimate only in the U.S. alone is $1 billion market, and this is only on the focus market that we look at only the indication, the primary indication of our device, which can expand to a lot more. My point here is that $1 billion company would not be two guys. It would be a lot of people. It would create a lot of jobs. It's not today yet, but it will. So, and that's one thing. And the last point that I want to make is that now we start having track record. We start a little bit. We start meeting with a lot of people. We get people excited about our technology. Actually, well, we had been talking to someone from university, Wake Forest University in Wisconsin. I'm sorry, North Carolina. That's a very different state. So they actually, and we talked, we actually last year we were invited to present in to Dr. Fogarty in California. There's an incubation program, you know, and we would need to move there. But, you know, and also with like North Carolina's, like they also want to collaborate, they want to get involved with us. I don't want to move here for both business and personal reason. But when you look at the business, Medtronic is here. Actually, we have very limited funding. When we did the animal study, we got a lot of help from Medtronic. And when we actually get to the market phase, you know, like these guys are going to help us a lot. So really, no reason to move for a business standpoint. So the commitment that I have with angel tax credits has actually helped me make the excuse. So I said to them, hey, you know, like we already have the commitment here. So we would like to, you know, it would be good for us to stay here. So it kind of like it makes an excuse for me to have them continue to collaborate and help us while we're still here. But it's like, you know, and if you think about this, we only raise relatively small money compared to the real company. But we're going to raise millions of dollars actually this year. When you think about that, how much money that we have to pay, I mean, you know, in order to be able to move. So I think that the point here is that the angel tax program definitely, you know, help retain the company here too. I mean, we have all the business reasons to be here already, but financial reason would actually make that case stronger. So this year, obviously, the angel tax has been run out. I mean, the funding has been run out. A small company like us, which is like, I mean, it's just me and a bunch of people that are helping. I don't have enough time to actually go do fundraising and then do a lot of development work. So we could not beat deadline. So that makes it really difficult for us to actually, it's actually easy for us to get people excited about what we do, and especially now we have the result. But now the funding is gone, so the investor like to put the money in, but they kind of, okay, well, should we wait for a few months for the money to come, or should we wait next year? But we need the money right now. Otherwise, you know, thing has to be put on hold, or we have to do some sort of financial arrangement, which, number one, add more work that doesn't need to be. Number two, we may have to even pay for interest for the short-term loans, which is a lot because we don't have collateral. So the point here is that this program is extremely useful, and it would help, you know, a guy like me, you know, to make not just my dream, but the idea. I'm a scientist. Any idea that I have, if it doesn't go to the product, if it doesn't really help people, especially working in the healthcare, it's not worth it, right? Because, like I said, they know cooling can help people 20 years ago. But look at today. People still die. People still have complications. Even though we know how to do that, but just because we don't have the technology. Now we know the technology, we have the technology, but we need financial help for that. So the program is very helpful. I would like to thank, you know, for the opportunity for me to share that.
So when do you go public?
Are you interested in investing, Mr. Chairman?
We are looking for investors.
Yeah, he's the guy to talk to. Well,
it's the IPO I'm wondering about. So do you have a patent on this?
Yes. We actually filed first patent. Actually, majority of our experience is on patents. We filed the first patent in 2011. And as we're speaking right now, our lawyer is actually drafting the applications that we're supposed to send out next Monday, the letters.
Is this a drug or is this a tool?
This is a device, sir.
A device.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
You like just stick it into the heart or what do you do?
Yes, it is actually, I should have brought my catheter with me.
You should.
I totally forgot about that. It is actually a catheter device that would put into directly to the heart, but we have a very unique design that is not like other catheter. I can share that a little bit. The normal catheter would go to the artery if it have a lot of risk. You know, when you put anything, when you do stent, you put that, you can create like stroke or something. But we go to the vein, which is the opposite side, the same direction when we do the pacemaker. So not only that, it has a lot of benefit in terms of the cooling, but it's actually very safe. It's actually also provide oxygen and drugs into the tissue too. So it's really, I don't want to get to a technical detail, but it has a lot of manifold of benefit.
Okay. All right. Senator here.
Mr. Ho Chan Run?
Sir.
Yeah. Sawadikap.
Sawadikap.
Just one. All right, you guys. That's enough.
Yeah. Well, I'm very glad that you came to testify, and I just wish you best of luck.
Thank you.
And if you ever cede any ground, there's plenty of space in the east side of St. Paul as well.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
So Commissioner, he said that there's no more money, no more credits left. Is that the issue?
Mr. Chair, Senators, yes, that is correct. We had $12 million in tax credits to distribute for this calendar year, and we ran out about a week ago.
For this calendar year?
For this calendar year.
Oh, so do we need to re-up this, or...?
The governor's budget ups the tax credit amount to $15 million.
Beginning when? Whenever it gets
beginning
passed.
This fiscal year, so July 1st.
July 1st, okay. All right. Okay. Any other comments or questions for the witness? Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senators, I think Promote said it the best. And I just wanted to add one final point, is that this is the one state-funded program that DEED has to support this segment of the business life cycle, startups in this very early stage. Next, if there aren't any questions on Angel Tax Credit, I'll move on to the next portion of governor's budget.
So, okay, just before we go any further, so what's the maximum that a company can get in angel tax credits?
I'd like to call Jeff Nelson, who's our angel tax credit coordinator, to answer some specifics.
Okay. He doesn't look like he's got a halo at all.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Jeff Nelson. I run the Angel Tax Credit Program for the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Businesses are eligible for up to $4 million in investment pursuant to the program, meaning no more than $1 million in credits per company.
$1 million per company. Okay. So, they have to leverage this. They have to leverage a certain amount of money from somebody else in order to get the credit. Is that how it works, or?
Mr. Chair, for example, an investor would invest $100,000 into a business. Because it's a 25% tax credit, they would then get a $25,000 rebate on their state income tax for that $100,000 investment.
Okay. And so we've already gone through $12 million this year?
Yes. So $12 million in credits equaling, that means $48 million in investment was made in just 2 months.
Okay. Very good. Okay. Any more questions, as long as he's up here? Okay. Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, just kind of to the point, what it illustrates is we've got a ripe opportunity for investment into new jobs and new startups or expansions. Is that something we've seen in the past, or has $12 million lasted longer prior years, or is this pretty normal that it goes in the first month or two?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the program has used up its funding more and more quickly every year. Last year, our funds lasted through mid-May. The year prior to that, it lasted through mid-July. And the year prior to that, it was through mid-November. I think part of the reason that we went through the $12 million for this year so quickly was because there was pent-up demand all the way from mid-May of last year to the end of the year, that companies and investors were sitting at the sidelines ready to go as soon as January 1st hit.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Richard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the question I would have is geographics of who's applied, the dollars that have went out, rural, suburb versus metro, that type of thing.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the program is geared specifically toward high-tech businesses. And if you look at a map of where the high-tech businesses in Minnesota are located, they are located primarily in the metro area. So therefore, it's not surprising that about 90% of the businesses and dollars are going to new businesses that are being started up by people in the metro area. Like Promote, our testifier, he previously worked at Boston Scientific. He lived in the metro area. Now he's starting his own business. He did not move to greater Minnesota. As the commissioner spoke earlier, we're finding that as the businesses that are receiving the benefit of this program, as they're growing, they are expanding some of their manufacturing to areas in greater Minnesota. So the whole state is benefiting from the program.
So, Commissioner, are you telling these people about the IRRRB?
Of course.
Okay, so we can get them to expand the rural Minnesota?
Of course.
Okay, all right.
And Mr. Chair and Senators, I would like to mention that this is one of the programs at DEED that is extremely well run, and would like to give Jeff some recognition. We receive constant accolades from businesses and investors that use this program and how efficient it is. And we did do outreach to Austin, Fergus Falls, Bemidji, Duluth, Little Falls, Hutchinson, Alexandria, Red Wing, and partnered with SBDC's Life Science Alley, Biobusiness Alliance, Southwest Initiative Foundation, and EDM to spread the word across greater Minnesota.
See, none of those were in the tech and tax relief.
And the IRRRB.
Okay. Go ahead. What's next? Anybody else have any questions on Angel Tax Credit?
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Senator Westrom.
Just wondering if they're open to a friendly amendment.
There's no amendment.
No amendment.
Well, I don't think there's anything in front of us, but go ahead. What are you thinking?
Well, maybe we could cook something up. But
you mean like a rural amendment?
Right.
That's a good idea. Okay. All right. Okay. Go ahead, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senators, second in the governor's budget is the Minnesota Investment Fund administrative costs, 3% of the recently appropriated $30 million in ongoing funding that was appropriated this last legislative session for the current biennium. MIF is our key economic development tool to attract new expansions and relocations to the state and ensure Minnesota businesses are expanding here in our state. We've already distributed $6 million since July 1st, and that $6 million has leveraged over $250 million in private investment. It's a fantastic program. And with MIF projects, they are all across the state, with an average of 82% of awards over the last 10 years have been in greater Minnesota. We are asking for 3% of the $30 million to be used for administrative costs. Our goal at DEED is always to ensure that businesses and our customers are receiving as much of the dollars as possible. We are only asking for what we believe is needed. And the reason why we're asking for this is we have some technology upgrades that need to happen in order for this this program and our economic development incentive programs to be administered appropriately. We currently use a database called IDB to track all of our economic development incentive transactions through MIF. And I'll remind you that MIF is a reimbursement program, so while we may make an award of $500,000 to a company, they receive that money back in reimbursements as they submit receipts. So it's not a one-time check that we're tracking. There are multiple transactions. IDB, our current database, was built in 1993 on Microsoft Access, and Microsoft is no longer supporting Access. There are a few Minute staff that do have the capability that are currently employed by Minute to help support this program, but we are seeing that we have a great need to transition to a new platform to ensure that we are tracking all transactions and also have the reporting function to be able to report by geographic location, by business industry, as well as historical data on what disbursements have been made and the total package of what companies have also received from cities and counties in addition to state. So this is not a new spending request. We are proposing that this be taken from the $30 million of MIF.
Commissioner, how did you get the $6 million out the door?
How did I get to $6
million? How did the $6 million get sent out the door without the 3%?
Oh, Mr. Chair, Senators, we currently have an IDB database that we're using, but it's based on Microsoft Access and Microsoft.
Oh, that I understood. So that works for you, but because your narrative says including staff time and technology, and so I'm assuming that you have the staff that you have is already being paid to do this.
Mr. Chair, Senators, yes, we do have staff in place that are being paid to administer these funds. However, this is a larger appropriation than what DEED has ever received. As you'll remember, MIF typically was historically appropriations of anywhere from $1 million to $7 million one-time funding. Now that we have $30 million in ongoing funding, we do think that we will have some additional staffing needs, but we will be as lean as we possibly can. The majority of this request is about the IT systems and making sure that we have appropriate systems in place to track all of the transactions.
Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't understand what you just said, that Microsoft is not supporting Microsoft Access. That's something that's an industry use every day of the week, and it, particularly in my company, we are creating new mm-hmm. Access databases on a daily basis, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Please tell me more why you think that Access is not being supported by Microsoft, or is there more to this mm-hmm. than that you didn't describe?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senators, my understanding is that that's not an ongoing platform that they're looking to continually support, but I can verify and get back to you if there's some question on that.
Mr. Chair? To follow up on that, I mean, if you're saying that you are transitioning from Access to a new platform, that's a whole different story, but when you say that it's not being supported, they're certainly providing software updates.
Mr. Chair, Senators, one point of clarification. It's around they're not supporting the coding language to further develop the database that we have in place that's based on Microsoft Access.
Mr. Chair. That's based on SQL. You mean to tell me that you don't have people that can program SQL language inside of an Access database? I could find you someone that can do that for you.
Are you looking for a job, or?
Not specifically, Mr. Chair, but I do know that they're out here. That's why I'm confused. I mean, if you're saying that the Access is antiquated, then that's one thing. But to say that it isn't supported, it's not another. If you're moving to a different one because of some technological reason, I'd like to hear it, because I'm not here as an advertisement for Microsoft Access. However, it is a very fully functional data warehouse. But feel free to enlighten me.
Go ahead. Just say your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, Kevin McKinnon, Director of Economic Development at Deed. Yes, the answer is not that they're not supporting Microsoft Access anymore. Our system is built on and through our Minute staff over the years on that foundation. And yes, we're transitioning to a new language within that database. And so are we still supporting it? Yes, it's my understanding that Minute is still supporting it. We have talked to Minute about this, and they've raised their concerns about transitioning over into a new language, and that's what we are talking about doing with that money.
Mr. Chair, could I have a better explanation as to why that transition is being? Is it something that detail of the needs exceed Access's performance, or can I? Because when you're unnecessarily transferring data warehouses or databases for no good reason, I wouldn't want to spend the money on this.
Right. Mr. Chair, members, that's the idea behind this whole process is, yes, to transition out of this database that's currently being supported by our Minute staff from something that they built in 1993, and yes, we'd be transitioning it into a new type of program that allows us to do more within that system and gather more information that's obviously being required of us quite continually.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, and Commissioner, do you have a history of something you want to say?
Mr. Jensen? Chairman, members, there's a little bit of budget history with this. Last biennium, MIF got $3 million. The commissioner's right, they got $30 million for this biennium, and the following biennium, it'll be another $30 million built into the base. We expect the work to be there. And when a committee has created new programs like the Job Creation Fund, $12 million each year this biennium, and it goes to $25 million following biennium, they get up to 3% for administrative expenses. And the competitive grant program, which was new in the 2012 session, they get up to 5% for administration and monitoring of all those programs that are monitored through the competitive grant program. So in this case, we just didn't give them any more money for 10 times as much money in the program.
Maybe we need to repeal those other administrative costs. And it seems like they're working just fine without it.
Commissioners here can comment on if they're working or not.
Okay. Go ahead, Commissioner. Because it seems to me we should just have an appropriation for the new software program that you want to put in, as opposed to doing a 3% across the board thing. But anyway, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, that concludes our testimony on that piece, but I'd be happy to answer any additional questions.
Okay. I don't see any, so go on to the next one.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members, next in the budget, the unemployment insurance debt interest rate. The governor recommends reducing the interest rate on unemployment insurance debt for both employers and individuals. This does not require a new appropriation and is also recommended by the UI Policy Committee. Deed charges interest on overdue tax payments from businesses, called underpayments, and on benefits we pay out to UI applicants as a result of fraud, a type of overpayment. On underpayments, tax payments can be late for a variety of reasons. Overpayments for fraud are more specific. This takes place when an individual knowingly makes a false statement or representation, deliberately fails to disclose material facts, or knowingly withholds information in order to obtain Minnesota unemployment insurance benefits. If For example, if someone with a full-time job applies for benefits but declares to Deed that they're totally unemployed, that person has committed UI applicant fraud. As you can imagine, ensuring timely tax payments and preventing UI applicant fraud are two of Deed's top priorities. Unemployment insurance overpayments and underpayments make the UI system more expensive for Minnesota's employers, stretch resources available for people who are out of work, and generally weaken the program. And we've made major investments in this area. For example, we have a computer system that cross-matches quarterly wages reported by employers with unemployment benefit payments made to applicants. We also have a team of specialists who verify information, investigate disputes, and follow up on tips from the public. These efforts have helped Minnesota's UI program to keep some of the best program integrity rates in the country, according to the Department of Labor. Unfortunately, we will always have situations in which overpayments and underpayments need to be addressed. So when we do find fraud, the penalties are stiff. For individuals who are overpaid as a result of fraud, we assess a non-negotiable 40% penalty on the total amount of the payment. We then charge 18% interest on the total, the principal of the overpayment plus the penalty, until it is repaid in full. So, for example, if an applicant is overpaid $1,000, a $400 penalty is assessed immediately, and the applicant will be charged 18% interest on the $1,400 total until the debt is repaid. For employers, there isn't a penalty payment, but the interest rate is still 18%. We've seen an increasing number of cases over the years in which employers and individuals making good faith efforts to correct their mistakes and get out of debt are unable to do so because of the unusually high interest rates. To help those individuals and businesses, we believe the UI debt interest rate should be reduced from 18% to 12%. And our reasons are that the 18% rate was set in 1982 when interest rates were generally much higher across the board. An 18% interest rate today is much more punitive than it was intended to be when first put into law. Other states seem to generally be in line with 12%. It is the most common interest rate nationally on UI debt. We believe a 12% interest rate is the best compromise. It's low enough to allow those who make a good faith effort to climb out of debt, but still high enough to incent individuals and employers to prioritize repayment. Interest charged on employer debt is paid to the unemployment insurance contingent account. The decrease in revenue to the UI contingent account with a 12% interest rate will be approximately $1.2 million per year. UI contingent account funds intended for use on technology upgrades and other one-time needs are frequently redirected to the general fund. Fiscal impact for fraud overpayments, interest charged on applicant fraud debt is paid to the UI trust fund. A 12% interest rate will reduce the trust fund by an estimated $2.68 million per year. The UI trust fund currently has a balance of over $1 billion, so this change will have a significant impact in that context. Overall, we believe these changes will give those who are honestly trying to correct their mistakes a better shot at doing so, while still a high enough penalty to incent repayments and protecting the integrity of Minnesota's UI system.
Boy, I thought we did this last year. Must have missed it somehow. But, Commissioner, on your example of a $1,000 fraudulent payment, is the $400 penalty on top of the $1,000 payback, or does it count toward the $1,000 payback?
The $400 penalty is assessed immediately and on top of the 18%.
So that's way more onerous than the 18% interest is. I wonder if maybe we should go to the penalty instead of to the interest, or a combination of both. Mr. Caligiuri, what do you think of that?
And Mr. Chair, members, I do want to also mention that there's not a penalty payment for employers.
Okay. Because I know I didn't realize there was an immediate 40% penalty. Isn't that high?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Caligiuri, the director of the unemployment insurance program at Deed. That is a stiff penalty, the 40%. The legislature revisited it a few years ago. the federal government has a requirement on a penalty level, and some of this penalty does go to that contingency fund as well. So it was at 35%, and or
do you have,
it was at 25%.
Do you have no discretion at all in the interest rate or in the penalty when you're collecting fraudulent overpayments?
The legislature has the governor of the legislature set it statutorily.
So you have no discretion at all?
No.
Would we be better off giving you discretion?
That would make my life difficult.
All right. How effective is the department in collecting these fraudulent overpayments? I mean, do you get the penalty and the overpayment back, or?
Mr. Chair, members, this whole topic of what's called UI integrity, it's a big issue nationwide, and the Department of Labor pushes hard on all states to meet certain guidelines regarding improper payments. So we're all under a lot of pressure to both identify improper payments quickly and to get them paid back. Minnesota does very, very well with this. We recently have developed the capacity to recapture revenue from both IRS refunds and, of course, from the Department of Revenue as well, and we get a significant amount of recapture that way. So Minnesota actually does very well in this area, but it's always an issue of concern. The 18% interest was set in the 80s, as the commissioner said. Interest rates were high then. Prior to that, for about 30 years, it was 12%, and that is kind of where most states are as far as charging interest.
Okay. Senator Osborne.
Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers, is it a fair statement to say that the interest that is charged, while seemingly onerous, however, also offsets the cost of actually incurred in providing or doing the program and doing the services and required behind the scenes to actually maintain the levels of that effort? In other words, are we deferring costs as a result of the additional revenue we capture above on that interest?
Mr. Chair, Senator, no, the interest that we gather, particularly with on the applicant side due to fraud, that is mandated by the feds that it goes directly to Minnesota's trust fund, which pays benefits.
All right. Any other comments or questions? Thank you. Okay, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members, and the final item in the governor's budget, Olmstead implementation. The governor recommends $500,000 in funds for the Olmstead Implementation Office. This is a new appropriation and one that we believe is absolutely necessary. A 1999 U.S. Supreme Court decision, Olmstead versus LC, found that Americans with Disabilities Act requires states to provide service to people with disabilities in the most integrated settings appropriate to their needs. The court came to this conclusion for two reasons. The first, that segregation of individuals with disabilities perpetuates the notion that some individuals are incapable or unworthy of participating in community life. And second, that such a segregation severely diminishes a person's life, family relations, social contacts, work options, economic independence, educational achievement, and cultural enrichment. In 2011, the Minnesota Department of Human Services entered into a settlement agreement that required the development of a Minnesota-specific Olmstead plan. That plan was developed over 2 years by a dedicated planning committee that included individuals with disabilities, family members, providers, and advocates, and the Olmstead subcabinet, a group of 8 state agencies established by Governor Dayton and led by Lieutenant Governor Pretner Solon. The plan, which went into effect in November of 2013, does more than provide vague assurances of future options. It has specific and reasonable timeframes and measurable goals for which public entities may be held accountable. These goals include, for example, commitments to individuals who are unnecessarily segregated in facilities, individuals with developmental disabilities, psychiatric hospitals, nursing homes, and board and care homes, and for individuals spending their days in sheltered workshops or segregated day programs. We also realize there are real opportunities for improvement in areas such as employment, transportation, housing, lifelong learning and education, healthcare and healthy living, community engagement, support and services. Federal court monitors are closely watching the progress of Minnesota's implementation and ensuring that we comply with a settlement agreement. To implement these changes in the agreed upon timeline, the state has established an Olmstead Implementation Committee, a cross-agency body that will oversee the implementation of our Olmstead plan. While the appropriation falls to Deed, this office will be involved with all agencies in state government. The Olmstead Implementation Office is temporarily and unsustainably staffed with individuals on loan from a few agencies and needs dedicated funding to continue its work. Governor Dayton and Deed are committed to ensuring people with disabilities have choices for competitive, meaningful, and sustained employment in the most integrated settings, but we need resources in order to achieve these goals and ensure that we remain in compliance with the settlement agreement. And at this point, I'll open for any questions.
And the governor's recommended $500,000 in the supplemental budget for it?
Correct.
Okay. Any questions on this? Senator Dietzick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. So the judge laid out all these, did he lay out all these findings? And so this gets you to those findings and helps address all those issues. And then are there just other issues that aren't addressed that jumps to a higher number in 16 and 17? Or is this because this is the bare minimum to get by?
Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to welcome our Deputy Commissioner, Cynthia Bowerly. This is an initial funding ask. We do believe that there could be additional funding needed in the future, but she's been the lead on this project, so I'll let her comment further.
Ms. Bowerly, there used to be a state rep by the name of Bowerly. Is any relation? Or?
Jerry Bowerly is my uncle and godfather.
Oh, okay. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Dietzick, the Olmstead plan was developed over the course of a couple of years and certainly was a part of the Jensen settlement requirement, but it is also broader than that settlement would necessarily require. It endeavors to provide Minnesotans with disabilities full access to the employment, the education, the lifestyle of their choosing so that they can live and work and participate in community life just as someone without a disability. And so this work really does require work across agencies. So how does transportation fit in with education, fit in with employment? So there is a great deal of work that is happening ongoing in agencies. This initial funding will get the office set up and running, but the plan, which is available online and was developed with a number of community meetings throughout the state, has ambitious goals over the next couple of years and will require ongoing work from all of the agencies and from the office.
Ms. Bowerly, why is the Olmstead decision in economic development and the Jensen is in health and human services? What's the reason for that?
The Olmstead office was initially housed at Deed as the subcabinet set it up. The subcabinet was established by an executive order from Governor Dayton in 2011. Deed is one of those agencies. We established the office there simply as a matter of getting it up and running quickly. It certainly could be housed in other agencies, but it is a collaborative work across agencies. DHS is very involved in this process as well, along with the eight other subcabinet agencies.
If I could add, Mr. Chair, it's closely related to the work that Deed does in vocational rehabilitation.
We have a bill on anything? Okay. Senator Dietzick.
Thank you. And I don't know if the testifiers know this or if Mr. Mueller knows it or anybody. Is there funding attached to the Jensen plan in HHS? And then how do they relate?
Mr. Chairman, members, the explanation is on page 10 of your document, but it's $1,400,000 in fiscal year 15. And then additional amounts in the out years for this program.
Okay. Now, we're going to have a bill eventually, I imagine. Are you in the process of writing it or presenting it, or who's what's going on here? Anybody know?
Mr. Chair, I believe I have a bill that I don't know if the if deed is part of it, but I think I have a bill that actually addresses some of this in the Olmsted plan, not the Jensen plan. It came to me from, I think they're coming to you to get your signature as well. So is
Senator Cohen planning on having us the supplemental budget bill for all of it, or do we know that yet, or nobody knows? Nobody knows anything here. Okay, that's good. All right. Okay. Any other questions on this? All right. Thank you, Ms. Bowerly. You can sit there as long as you want. All right. Commissioner, are you doing our job creation fund update now?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members, so just wanted to give a brief update on the new Minnesota Job Creation Fund, which you all passed this past legislative session. We now have $24 million, and the program officially launched on January 1st and is underway, and we are already receiving requests from businesses. So in the fall of 2013, DEED staff held meetings about the Job Creation Fund with over 100 local government officials in Duluth, Rochester, St. Cloud, Bemidji, Mankato, Fergus Falls, Burnsville, and Brooklyn Park. And in January and early February, we held another 11 outreach meetings in Thief River Falls, Bemidji, Marshall, Fergus Falls, Wilmer, Little Falls, Cottage Grove, North St. Paul, North Mankato, Eden Prairie, and Maple Grove, with over 200 attendees statewide at those meetings.
Commissioner, I just want to point out you weren't attacking a tax relief area again.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear.
You weren't in the Taconite tax relief area again. I just want to point that out. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, all right.
So I'm excited to report that our very early applicant pool, four projects are located in greater Minnesota, two from the Twin Cities. These are early signs of strong statewide demand and a great indication of how the Job Creation Fund will create results for communities large and small across our state. So I look forward to providing additional updates as this program progresses, but we are seeing great interest already.
And just remind us how it works, because this is based on how many people you hire, right?
This is a pay-for-performance program. So based on the number of new jobs a company creates, the level of private investment the company makes, and the wages of those jobs, it's a formula that helps develop what level of rebate they are eligible for. We set a business subsidy agreement up front with the business. Once they create those jobs, once that level of private investment is made, then they are eligible to receive that rebate.
Is there a maximum?
There is a $1 million maximum, with one exception for, I believe it's 200 or more new jobs. That can go up to $2 million maximum.
Okay. Any comments or questions on the program? All right. And we have Workforce Development and Competitive Grant update.
Mr. Chair, members, the Adult Workforce Competitive Grant Program, started by the legislature in 2011, is designed to increase skill development and employment opportunities for unemployed and underemployed.
Oh, wait, Commissioner, maybe before we go on, how does the Baxter thing going? I'm not supposed to say that word yet?
No, you can. Okay. Chair, members, it's going well. Okay. We are in constant communication with them, and I think they'll be making additional announcements soon.
So they haven't pulled the trigger yet?
It is in process, yes, but they haven't made a public announcement yet.
And so they don't have anything in place yet, though. They're still deciding to go to Brooklyn Park? Where is it, Brooklyn Center?
They do have a location in Brooklyn Park identified.
All right. But they haven't done any kind of construction or any kind of moving of any jobs there yet.
Mr. Chair, members, they actually are using an existing building with equipment that's in that building, so it'll be remodel versus brand-new construction.
And we gave them a special incentive, right? We gave them $3 million.
Yes.
Is that correct? And do they qualify then for the per-job rebate also?
Yes, they do qualify for the Minnesota Job Creation Fund.
Okay. All right. Okay. Sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members, the Adult Workforce Competitive Grant Program, designed to increase skill development and employment opportunities for unemployed and underemployed Minnesotans. This program puts a special emphasis on organizations serving populations with certain barriers to employment, specifically individuals identifying with racial or ethnic minority groups, veterans, older workers, the long-term unemployed, individuals in transition to work from public assistance, and individuals with disabilities, including individuals who are deaf or hard of hearing. The evaluation of competitive grant proposals followed the guidelines set in the request for proposals issued in July. DEED selected organizations for grant awards based on their ability to help participating individuals from targeted populations obtain, retain, and advance in unsubsidized employment and or complete training along an educational path. To score proposals, a team of grant evaluators ensured a fair comparison by considering project design, organizational capacity, partnerships, project sustainability, assessment and evaluation, and of the overall budget. In response to this program's most recent request for proposals, DEED received proposals from 37 organizations requesting a total of $20,326,004 in funds. DEED selected 24 organizations for funding, awarding a total of $6,237,700, which was the full appropriation, for programs projected to serve 3,041 individuals across the state. Of that amount, over $1 million was distributed to organizations in North Minneapolis. Unfortunately, with such a high volume of requests and limited financial resources, it was inevitable the good programs and quality providers would not receive funding. In a review done by the DEED team, if all of the quality proposals submitted would have received awards, the full amount of funding would have been $14 million instead of the $6,237,700 appropriated to DEED to administer this program. Populations served benefit in a number of ways from a competitive funding model. Through the competitive process, DEED is able to prioritize projects based on labor markets and regional employment trends. A competitive funding model allows DEED to leverage investment from other state agencies and partners and provide targeted programs for shared customers. Competitive grants help maximize the state of Minnesota's limited general fund resources, encourage stronger outcomes for program participants, and provide greater accountability and outcome data to Minnesota taxpayers. And at this point, we'll open up for any questions.
You said you used the phrase projected to serve how many people?
3,041.
And I assume that you have some kind of a tracking method to find out if they actually do what they claim they're going to do?
Mr. Chair, members, yes, we do. So as we are reviewing applications, we ask for specifically how many people they will serve and what populations they plan to serve. And then as the grant progresses, that is information that we are collecting from the organization and compiling for our records.
So since we're talking about supplemental budgets, do you have any intention to ask for more money for this program since you could serve so many more people?
Mr. Chair and members, this past appropriation was for the biennium. We definitely see a need for increased funding for this program, and I would love to come back to you potentially next session with a request.
Okay. But if we gave you more, you'd figure out what to do with it, right?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, is that ever a problem around here?
I don't know. It's not very often that they say we ran out of money. Well, we didn't use all the money is what I mean.
So you're saying don't give us the money we don't want. It doesn't usually come up around here.
Well,
no.
Normally they spend whatever we give, or at least they tell us they did. In this case, I think she has pretty good paperwork. So, all right. Are there any questions of the commissioner, Senator Dietzick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, so Twin Cities Rise was here earlier, and I'm sorry I missed that, but I believe they were one of the organizations. There was a few that I heard from over the summer that, like you mentioned, there were several, clearly qualified and some quality organizations that didn't get funded. How do you, is there a process in place, and can you just very briefly go through how that process works I mean, we just had a lot of concerns and questions. And then who decides? I know there was a lot of discussion last year. I think the Senate bill actually had the Senate appropriating and the House went to the grant process. And so can you just kind of walk us through how some of that is decided so that we can share with our constituents when they come to us with concerns? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, we do have a specific process outlined in the RFP and data that we're collecting. And I'd like to invite our Deputy Commissioner, Cynthia Bowerly, to provide more data on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senators. We do have, we put out an RFP for this proposal, as we do with any other grant. It lays out in detail for the individual groups that may want to provide a proposal what the scoring criteria will be, down to 5 points for this type of, so that information is all available to them. We have a process where we provide a webinar where anyone who is interested in proposing can ask questions about the process if they need assistance or understanding about what particular definitions might mean in the proposal. We have staff available to answer them. Because it is a public process, if an organization asks a question, that question is then put up on our website for all to see. And then once the deadline passes for applications, we have a grant review team who score the individual proposals. And then that is compiled and reviewed by managers in the program to just to make sure if there's any anomalies or things. And then, again, the amount of funding that we had, there we had to make some draw some lines as to where the funding cutoffs were, and not any proposal, even the very top score, did they get the full amount of their request. So the money was spread out across as many grant proposals that we could, and we're able to fund 24 this year.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Seeing none. Commissioner, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll be in touch, I guess, this session yet. So thank you. Senator Brown, Senate File 1746. And Senator Brown, you weren't here earlier, but when Senator Pappas did her bill, I announced that we're not taking any votes on any bills unless you have some kind of an amendment that you need to add to the bill. And so we'll listen to the bill and then lay it over. Okay.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And with that, I have before us the House version. Well, it's a companion bill to the House version, Senate File number 1746. And it's proposing taking $100,000 of money that was appropriated to the Minnesota, let me find the exact language, Film and Minnesota Film and TV Board that has not been used, and moving it to a new provision that would be the Mille Lacs Tourism Council. Members, the Mille Lacs Lake area has been hit hard in a decline in tourism, and we're trying to find solutions to help them in terms of marketing and advertising to bring people back to that area. I am working with putting together a group of people to find long-term solutions. I'm working with the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe and the Mille Lacs Tourism Council and many other stakeholders in that area. This would be a very short-term help, but I am working with a stakeholder group to find a longer-term solution. So with that, Mr. Chair, I do have two testifiers here today.
Okay. Bring them up to the table, please, whoever. Just say your name for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Tina Chapman, and I'm the Executive Director of the Mille Lacs Area Tourism Council. The Mille Lacs area and its businesses will be facing some very difficult years ahead due to the extremely low walleye safe harvest quotas, the DNR is tightening our walleye fishing regulations, as well as the distressed health of the lake. The area and its businesses are feeling the impact now. Mille Lacs Area Tourism is a marketing co-op and is primarily funded through lodging tax. This year, two of our larger contributors have closed for business, thus cutting our marketing dollars. Many of our lodging members anticipate or have already experienced a drop in business, which also means a drop in marketing funds. We anticipate a drop of 20% in lodging tax this year. We are currently working with Explore Minnesota Tourism, and we have already hired a marketing company to assist us with the new identity strategy through website enhancements and other media. They are assisting us with press releases and social media to help offset the negative impact the lake constantly receives. It's critical that we receive additional funding to drive further development of these programs, and we are diligently working to enhance the perception of Mille Lacs as being more than just a fishing destination. We know it will take time and money to change people's perception of Mille Lacs, but all of us agree that this is the first step to ensure our existence. In closing, the Mille Lacs area needs your help to bridge the huge detriment we are facing. And then I'd like to introduce Karen McCoy, who's a business owner.
Good afternoon. My name is Karen McCoy. My husband and I own a resort on the southeast corner of the Lake Mille Lacs. I'm here to testify about the economic situation for us as a resort owner as a result of many of the factors continuing to erode our ability to operate what amounts to a small family-owned resort just 90 minutes from here. I'm a member of the Chamber of Commerce in our area. I'm a member of the Tourism Council and also a parent of one child in our junior high schools, and I will speak of that. In any business, as you know, there are ups and downs. And we've all felt our pocketbooks the effect of a difficult economy nationally for the past 5 years. We've certainly felt it in our tourism industry. We've been treading water until then. Pardon the lake pun, but I'm a walleye fisherman. But we trade on location, location, location. We trade on the fact that we're 90 minutes away from Mille Lacs. And so even though the economy suffered, we were able to help draw several people from the Twin Cities as an area that they could drive up to, despite high gas prices, et cetera, to come to our area. Unfortunately, when we thought the light was at the end of the tunnel and our economy was going to turn around some more, recent conditions have just eroded our situation further. There's challenges like our fishery, questions of the health of the walleye population, the invasive species. There's political effects that continue to polarize our area, unfortunately. And our media does not help our situation. They tend to want to sell newspapers or get ratings on their TV shows, so they tend to highlight the negatives, the more exciting stories, like a truck going through the lake in southeast Minnesota and how somehow that should scare you from coming to our Lake Mille Lacs. Despite this, I can honestly tell you that we do our best to promote the area and put a positive spin on it. Enjoy the area. This is one of Minnesota's key treasures. We have trophy fish to offer you, even if you can't keep many fish. There are other things to do here. We have ATV trails. We have snowmobile trails. We have craft shops. Many things, many activities for all of you to come and enjoy at Mille Lacs. Unfortunately, the recent DNR announcement of a significantly reduced walleye harvest down from, I believe it was 210,000 pounds last year to 60,000 pounds this year, has made our once challenging conditions, frankly, damn near impossible. On a personal note, as a business owner, I want you to know that we're a family resort. We've been there for 20 years. We're similar to most of the resorts on the lake. Most of us are mom-and-pop shops doing the best we can with what we have. However, for 4 of the 6 past years, our income has decreased. In this last winter season, with the regulations pending and the news articles flying, our reduction in business was 40%. We were hit by 40% drop just with the potential of the situations going on in our lake, even before the limit was enforced. Currently, to put it in perspective for you, our revenue as a 20-year business doing fairly well compared to several others on the lake, our revenue is at the levels of nearly a decade ago. We need your help. We need relief. We can continue to work to counter the perceptions, like Tina has just described to you, from a tourism perspective. And we will endure, and we will do our best to survive, despite the walleye regulations coming up. But I want you to know that this relief is not just needed for Mille Lacs resorts. Like all of Minnesota, tourism is key. It's critical to our communities, including the towns of Isle, Onamia, Garrison, Malmo, several counties as well, Mille Lacs, Aiken, Crow Wing. It's a trickle-down effect. Without tourism dollars, local businesses, of course, see reduced revenue. Jobs are lost. tax revenues are reduced. Families leave to find work. Maybe they take their families, as we know many of our friends, have gone to North Dakota to work on the oil fields. Our school recently failed to pass a referendum because in 1 year they will go into deficit spending because they can no longer afford to operate our schools. Our enrollment has gone down from 500 students to 400 students, and that includes significant efforts to open and enroll more students to draw revenue. So if you think 100 students in our outstate area, we receive about $6,000 per student. That's a $600,000 cut to our budget at the school level. And you might be interested to know, sadly, our board recently cut art, they cut band, they cut our one-act play, they cut our pep band. They cut many of our fine arts programs from our curriculum because of these reductions, because we don't have people there. Nobody's working in the area bringing their kids to the schools. So the fine arts are cut. One of our three math teachers was just let go. And despite what we all know about obesity in our nation, we no longer have an elementary phi ed teacher. This is just so that our school can survive and make it to the next year and pray that a referendum will pass. So I'm asking for relief. It's a trickle-down effect from walleye fishing to loss of jobs, elimination of fine arts, and potentially elimination of our school district. We need your help to stop the cycle. Help us renew the viability of one of our state's key tourism attractions. Helping Mille Lacs tourism helps our businesses, our school district, and truthfully, the survival of our communities. Thank you.
Thank you. Any comments or questions from the committee? Senator Brown, I think we have to make a little change. Mr. Jensen, you want to explain it? It looks like the way it's written, it doesn't work. So,
Mr. Chairman, on page 4, the reduction in the appropriation on line 4.26 and 4.27 is in the second year, which is 2015, and the new appropriation on page 6, $100,000, is in 2014. So they should be in the same fiscal year to make it work.
So, Senator Brown, we're going to change 2014 to 2015, okay? So,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
So Senator Ingebrigtsen moves the change on line 6.23, change 2014 to 2015. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Motion is adopted. You said something interesting in the beginning, Senator Brown, that the $100,000 isn't being used by the TV and Film Board. What did you mean? What did you
I
mean
should have
that?
Said hasn't been used.
Hasn't been used.
Yes.
Okay, hasn't been used. Because we haven't gotten to that year yet, maybe, but okay. All right. So are there any questions or comments about this? Do you don't have any other testifiers?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Is there anybody else in the audience that would like to say something on this bill? Okay. Very good testimony, by the way. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. We're going to lay this over for possible inclusion in what we think might be an omnibus bill, but we haven't exactly determined it yet. Sorry.
All right.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. That's it for the committee today, members, and unless somebody wants to do something good. Special here. So, meeting adjourned.
Yeah. Drop in any time.